Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Okay. This morning's talk is about a question that was posed by a 12th century Zen master, Songyuan Chongyue. And it's treated like a koan. And a koan is a question or a phrase that you hold in your heart as it works with you throughout your life. And the title of it, or the question is, why can't clear-eyed bodhisattvas sever the red thread? And for those of you who might be new, a bodhisattva, many people have different ideas about bodhisattvas. But for me, they are an archetype for our human potential. But they also are a supreme being of sorts. So why can't the clear-eyed bodhisattvas sever the red thread? So what is the red thread? So I thought I'd start with a story to kind of illustrate that. The story is, I was in session and I was doing Dokusan, which is face-to-face meeting. And there were two people in the session. And one of them was a priest in training, and one of them was a very sincere long-time practitioner. And they were very good friends. And during the course of the retreat, I learned that they had broken up as friends. That though they were very, very dear friends, one of them had said something that had hurt the other. And the other person came back and said, "Wow, that really hurt me." And the first person said, was defensive and said, "Well, I meant it this way," and so forth. And the second one felt unheard. And tried again. "You really hurt me." And this first one said, "I feel unseen. You're not listening. You're not listening." And the fallout from all that was emails and finally the decision that I don't want to hear from you. That's it. And here they were sitting in session together. In silence, close. And they were very scared and fearful. And the one said, worried about her position, went around and checked around. "Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I think. What do you, you know, am I off base?" "No, no, she was confirmed that no, that was, she was hearing it right." And she said to me in Dokusan, "I know I'm right." And I felt my heart just break because they were dear friends, close friends. So that's the red thread. There we were, all of us sitting with the red thread. Our deep karmic entanglements pull us in. Our body, our heart, our mind fold in on each other, trying to resolve. Trying to understand, unravel that deep emotion, they won't. resolve itself. The temptation to justify the hurt in "I'm right." Feeling helpless, we try to ignore it or busy ourselves in a project until that deep wound starts to dull itself. But in my experience, the red thread always comes back because we can't fix it with our mind. It isn't easy to admit that I can't accept life just as it is. It's often cruel or uncaring, sometimes boring or beyond help. But the red thread reminds us of our commitment not to abandon life. It is our loving ancestors who pointing to the way of liberation, holding us to our vow. Unlike the arhat, who has insight into true existence and free from emotional entanglements, the Mahayana ancestors, who our lineage are part of, where Mahayana is Soto Zen, return us to the marketplace to stay connected to our humanness. Our red thread that over and over again breaks our heart. That is just this turning towards our life and caring for it that nourishes the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. In the universal gateway that we chant in the morning, we are told to mindfully remember Kanzeon or Avalokiteshvara, to remember the true existence of all beings, that in the middle of our distress, our heart knows how to heal the suffering. The red thread is often thought of as the lifeblood. It includes the messy parts of who we are, the parts we don't want to look at, the parts we don't want to talk about, the socially taboo, desire, and our problematic bodies, our faults, and our entanglements. It's all of life. It includes the pain and the joy, despair and suffering, bliss, and our empathy, love, loss, and finally death. For me, it feels like it hits below the belt sometimes. Or the expression "seeing red" came to mind. Last week, Jiko talked about the three passions: greed, hatred, and ignorance, or sometimes we call them the three poisons. These poisons or passions endlessly arise, and depending on our karma and conditions. And what I heard her say was she wanted us not to think they will ever end. They are endless. Or to think we're above it. I'm cool. My practice is cool. I got this. That given extreme conditions, we are vulnerable to extreme actions. And so to me, that kind of brings to mind all the times we judge other people, right? We don't know. You don't know what they've lived through. You don't know what their morning was like. We don't know. And if we are alive, this is always true. And to not put off working with them in our practice, she urged us to look directly at how they're showing up every day. The red thread demands respect. What does that mean? The seeing again of all life. To look again at the person. It requires a wide view that is imaginative and liberating. Holding our gaze until we embrace all things equally, with no exception, is the challenge. I sometimes think about when I first heard Bodhidharma's phrase that has been very important to many practitioners is everything is equal, nothing is holy. But when I first heard that phrase, I thought, oh, is that true? And then I thought, wow, no, life is very unequal. What is he talking about? But if that's true, then the second part of the phrase would be, everything is sacred. Everything is holy. That was a tall order, I thought, for practice. So I'm not talking about the idea of holding things, all things equally, because that actually isn't so hard. The red thread flows from our heart. It mindlessly touches our irritability. It mindlessly pokes at our cherished beliefs and what we find unacceptable. It shares our joy at birth and life celebration and grief at the loss and death. So if we're human, and we are, we're going to have to deal with the red thread. So the question was, why can't the clear-eyed bodhisattva, the wise bodhisattva, the compassionate bodhisattva, sever that red thread? When I first came to Zen, that is just what I wanted to do. Sever that thing. I wanted to be rid of the ups and downs. They're painful. And cast aside the worldly concerns. What a big, chaotic mess life is. And I felt like I was a mess too. And I love the cool gaze of the Buddha images. That's what I want. And for a while, that served a purpose, to create space for me to settle down and cry, to feel the exhaustion of trying to hold together a world that was continuously falling apart. So I built a little magic city, and I found a place to rest. So be it, I thought. And as the universe would have it, it was just at this moment that I heard this question. The talk was late at night and in the middle of Sesshin. It was quiet, and it was dark. We were out on a farm. The teacher was from San Francisco, and he was helping. He had set up a home for homeless people who were dying of AIDS during the AIDS epidemic. And for those of you who were too young to remember, it was a very traumatic time. And he had taken it upon himself to give some dignity to a few people in a crisis. At the time, I couldn't make much sense of his talk. I don't know if it was my inability to hear it or he himself was not clear. But in the middle, the teacher simply fell silent. And there we were. And in Adokas, or in Dharma talks, just like now, we were all facing each other, and it was a small room, not big like this, but you know, small. And there we were, just facing each other. And the teacher had gone silent. What to do? What to say? The koan never left me after that. It walked with me through my chaplaincy and my hospice work. And it somehow held me during some of the most trying situations, as if saying, this too, and you hold this. The undeniable truth of our existence and our connection with all that is. The teacher, they actually work with this question a lot in the Rinzai tradition, which is where I heard it. The teacher was Rinzai. But there's a teacher, Susan Murphy, who wrote on this, and she said, the red thread that cannot be cut is what draws us to the practice where this can hurt enough to stir us to life. Wake up, as if to say, wake up. Because in the end, to cut the red thread is to cut out our life. And sometimes we do. Sometimes it's more than we can face. But when we cut out the grief of death, we also cut out the joy of birth. And this is not the path of the Bodhisattva. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. The Bodhisattva doesn't just tolerate conditions. They cultivate patience, the willingness to stay in the midst of it all with a loving embrace. At once we come face to face with our true self, an intimate encounter with beauty. Thich Nhat Hanh, who had a very traumatic first part of his life, I think often touches this part really eloquently. And he said, a simultaneous gathering in and releasing of our objections, our judgments, or our knowing that I'm right, we are moved by love. And this love changes our nature. So even though I might be talking about something very underbelly, like the underbelly, the rewards are so great. There's a time in our practice when we go beyond looking at our mental states and accept just who we are. The warm heart of bodhicitta wells up in us. And we understand that our personal story is part of the whole human story. And we can care deeply for the welfare of all beings. I sometimes test myself with this. When I meet somebody, I think, do I love them as much as I love my daughter? That's a rough practice. I don't often win that one. When I am overwhelmed by a situation and I feel a great depth of emotion, like, say, maybe loneliness, I think of the people all over the world at that moment that might be feeling lonely right now. And I'm pretty sure there's a lot, usually. I hold them in my heart and I give them metta. I say something like, may I and all beings who are lonely right now be filled with loving kindness. May I, with all beings right now who are feeling lonely, be filled with loving kindness. Or sometimes I have the thought, or may I feel their loneliness. May I take on the loneliness of all those people, so that they might have some peace and ease. As long as I'm going to be lonely, bring it on. Just bring it on. And would I take that? Yes, I will take that so that you don't have to. That's a wish. At that point, the self dissolves when you do that. This central story of who I am and what I'm about. And it dissolves into what Dogen calls the actual body, or the true body, which is who we really are. We no longer think we are separate. We know we are not, and we know it in our being, not just in our thoughts. We are never alone. Our suffering is also both our personal suffering, our personal story, and it's the universal story. As humans, we get lonely. We have grief. But we can also share each other's joy. In session, we can sometimes taste this interbeing. That's what Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, of the self and the universe. But we're in this together, just us. Although it is always like this, sometimes we forget. It can be forgetful. Then we get caught in our poisons. Restored to love, we can take responsibility for our thoughts, our speech, our action, which renews our energy. I find that gives me great amount of energy and gives us power that conquers that fear and despair. There's a real upside, and we can accept with gratitude and respect the true self that is beyond comprehension. I don't know how it all works, or why it works, or what's behind it. In the Book of Serenity, there's a case, another koan, case number 94. Dongshan, who is one of our ancestors, is unwell. And when I heard this koan, I understood Dongshan as being close to death. Kind of the closing, end of his life, getting near the end of his life. And the case reads like this. Dongshan is unwell, and the monk asks, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" And Dongshan says, "There is." The monk says, "Does the one who is not ill look after you like a mother to a child?" And Dongshan says, "I have the opportunity to look after him." A little bit of a shh, which is what koans do. And the monk says, "How is it when you look after him?" And Dongshan says, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." So this koan, I think I was working with it when I was a chaplain. And in this koan, the master is very ill, near death. And as we know, old age, sickness, and death are inescapable. At this time, Dongshan is faced with his own mortality. And I often think of the monk as Dongshan's jisha. And the jisha is a close attendant who is very intimate with the teacher and learns to watch the teacher. And they ask the question. So he's kind of bold and asks a question which would be typically kind of personal. Is there anyone who does not get ill? And this kind of lands on me in different ways. There's the alas. Is there anyone who doesn't get ill or sick or die? Like, this is us. This is us. Sometimes it lands like a gentle nudge. It's more like my parent. Get over it. Make the best of it. Maybe with a little humor. Yeah, is there anybody else who doesn't get this way? So let's make the best of it. And sometimes I hear it as a sweet interchange between two monks in a quiet of the night, and sharing a cup of tea. Is there anyone who doesn't get ill? And then to his surprise, Dongchen says, well, there is. There is one who doesn't get ill. Well, the monk picks up his ears, like we're going to go someplace different. And he has a little fun. Does the one who is not ill take care of you? Perhaps he was thinking of himself taking care of his teacher. And again, Dongshan goes against our conventional thinking and says, there is one who is ill. The one who is ill has the opportunity to look after the one who is well. I always see this as an effortlessness in the master to be with something so tender as his fading life. He not only can do it, but he has the opportunity to look after his actual body, his life. This is a real twist. Usually when I'm sick, I want somebody to take care of me. It's a kind of like a cosmic dance of the relative and the absolute nature of the self. Joyful in every step and never losing each other's gaze, they take care of each other, the actual body and the personal body. So finally, the monk says, how is it when you look after the one who is well? And Dongshan responds, but then I don't see that he has an illness. Then it's gone. Nothing has changed. Nothing in the room has changed. But now he sees that it's gone. The illness is gone. The looking after the one who is well becomes the medicine that heals the sickness. The red thread becomes woven into an endless fabric that is both particular and universal. To be intimate with life in the quietness of living. When there is nothing more to say, kind of like that Zen teacher. Let go of the urgency, the wishes, and the distractions. We are at last home. We are enlightened each moment with true attention. That reminds me of a Thich Nhat Hanh gatha that I used to say quite a bit, where it starts out, I'm arriving, I'm home. In the here and the now, solid, I'm free, in the ultimate, I dwell. That kind of held me through some tough times. So here we are, right now, in emptiness, nothing special. Nothing needs to be added. Nothing needs to be solved or taken away. When we do this practice, we let go of our safeguards that give us a false sense of security and ease gives us a false sense of security. And we set ourselves on shaky ground, just like at the beginning when I was talking about how the world is a chaotic mess. It is. But that hasn't changed really. But here is where the lotus blooms. So here's where we sit. The clear-eyed bodhisattvas see the true reality, and it includes the red thread. It includes all of who we are. So I'll leave this talk with a quote by, I think it's from Susan Murphy, I read it. And it's very poignant for me at this time in my life, kind of at the end of my life. Life is the gift you give away. I'll leave you with that koan to practice with. And thank you very much.
Have an opportunity to ask questions. If you're on Zoom, feel free to type a question into the chat box or your name, and you'll be unmuted. If you're in the room, please start with your name and speak into the microphone.
Hi, this is Genko. My late partner spent the last 3 weeks of her life in critical care, gradually approaching death. And probably I would say two or three days before she died, the doctor came in and said, "How are you doing?" She said, "I'm doing great. I'm gaining weight. I'm eating better. I'm breathing better." And I'm sitting there looking, because I've been spending a lot of time with her. I'm sitting there looking at her and going, "None of this is true. None of this is true. What are you talking about?" But I didn't say anything. It was just like, "That's very strange." And the doctor kind of listened to all this and kind of went, looked at her chart, kind of went, So I asked Kyogen about this some weeks later and said, "This was very confusing to me. You know, what's really going on there?" And what he said was, "Well, she was looking at it in an absolute manner, and I was looking at it in a relative manner." And given the situation I was in as a caregiver and, like, you know, being right there, kind of gatekeeper or whatever, obviously I was in the relative world. But she was fine, you know. And I had that sense. I mean, when I thought about it, it's like, yeah, she felt like she was doing just great. And that's always been a very interesting phenomenon to me.
How did you feel at that moment? Was it comforting to hear her, or was it so discordant that it was disturbing?
It was just confusing. It was just like, I wonder. I was just curious about it. And then when Kyogen put it into relative and absolute, I was like, oh, now I get relative and absolute, because, you know, it's hard to understand what that is. But that was one really clear way of saying this is what's happening here. And it wasn't as though either of us was wrong. We were both right. So that's kind of how that worked.
That's a very sweet story.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Charlie. What I'm most curious about is your metta practice you mentioned in feeling an intense emotion and offering love and kindness. And then the second metta practice of taking on that emotion. Those sounded like different practices, and yet you explained them as the same.
Well, it kind of morphed into, as I think maybe my practice matured a little more, I was willing to take on all beings, loneliness. But at the beginning of it, and sometimes even now when I don't feel like I'm really feeling it, I just want to join with all beings that are feeling that way at that moment. I don't know who they are, but I feel then the connection into that interconnectedness of us all. And it doesn't feel so separate and fearful. I realize, oh. And I think when I first started doing it, you do it just, I did it just kind of on impulse. I was so miserable. I didn't know what to do. And that was what came up. And I immediately felt held and comforted, and realizing, I think later, maybe when I wasn't just so saturated with that emotion, I could see what's true. You know, at any given time, people are having whatever you're experiencing. And that's just, I mean, I don't even know, you don't know. You know, maybe the bunny rabbit's feeling lonely. We don't know. I mean, let yourself, you don't know.
Thank you.
This is Nancy. Thank you for your talk, Vish. I wanted to follow that, pardon the pun, thread a little bit, talking about metta. And I heard Sato give a talk about Tonglen one time, and I think she was quoting or referring to something that Pema Chodron has written about that practice, which, as you were describing how you were feeling, I just remember taking away that what I was reading is like, this is hard. This is like, this just isn't metta. This is like the next level. And I'm not sure that we in this Sangha pursue Tonglen that much. But in your teaching or in your practice or sharing, can you say anything about that?
Yeah, my teacher did Tonglen. I tended to do metta. She tended to do Tonglen. And the first time I did Tonglen, it hurt my heart so much, I had to stop.
Is that more Theravadan or versus Mahayana or
Vajrayana?
Vajrayana, okay.
I love having this person
right, right there. Google it.
Yeah, but it has the same effect. And for those of you who don't know what Nancy's talking about, it's you breathe in the. Sometimes you start with you breathe in just like darkness. Or ash, or there's a story. There's a story that I remember hearing that always touched my heart, where this woman's son had died of a heroin overdose, and she was beside herself. She couldn't move, and the teacher had suggested Tonglen, and she's like, "No way." No way, I can't do that. And she was looking at a newspaper article, and there was a hockey team, a picture of the whole team, and they came in second. She said, oh, I can do Tonglen with that. Right? You don't take on the mother load. You take on, you practice. You know, so she practiced, I mean, taking in the, what all, whatever those emotions might be, of coming in second, the team, and holding it, you hold it in your heart center, and then you exhale. Usually they say like flowers or stars or a light, you know, a release, however you can imagine that.
Thank you.
This is Amy. I really enjoyed your talk. I was thinking about how since probably like 2020, I've been trying to cut the thread by going like really analog, like get a landline, get a flip phone, get a newspaper, and like that. And it doesn't work. Like it's not working. And the whole time I've been just tortured by this like quest, and also realizing in your talk that like part of the reason that I'm so stuck and it's not working is that nobody else will join me. Like I'm like, you know, crusader of Luddite 40 something, or I don't know. And it's that nobody else will do it with me. That's why I'm so miserable or whatever. And like being convinced that I'm right. Like, if only
I hear
we just
that in the story.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed like reframing it that way of like, I can still do it. I don't have to just be right and have that be like the issue. And I wanted to ask, one thing that you mentioned was that you've used this story, or it's come up for you and it's been helpful for you, like remembering it over certain times of your life. So I just wanted to ask if you had more like to share about that. Like, how has it been helpful?
Well, when you take on something like a koan, sometimes it's just a turning phrase from your chants or whatever's engaging your heart. And you just do the dishes. You know, why can't the bodhisattva, why can't they sever? Why can't I do that? You know, walk to the bus stop. Why can't, you know, what is the red thread? I don't even want to talk. Personally, I don't even want to talk about the red thread. It goes to some dark places for me. So you just pick it up and then you go to work and you turn the computer on again. So that's how you work with something like that. And you just let it inform the now moment, the lived moment with your teacher. Eventually, well, I don't, everybody experiences it differently, but for me, it was just like, I just felt Sangyuan Guanwei right here with me. Like, kind of like my personal protector. so I wasn't, you know, so that they were there, but you just bring it with you. You live with it. Then you forget it, and you live with it, and you forget it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good luck with your practice.
Hey, yeah, I really enjoyed listening to your talk as well. And I liked what you said. I could relate to like the chaos of life, feeling too much and wanting to like cut, I guess in my perspective, it was like feelings kind of like to not feel anything. But then also to realize that if I'm not feeling anything, I'm not feeling, there's no joy or like the things that I tend to like, enjoy more or find more pleasant without the other side of it. And I was curious as to when you mentioned the three poisons or the three, the greed and hatred and delusion. I was wondering if that was in relation to the red thread, like, is that part of being a human as well and not something that one should expect to be rid of?
Yes. Oh. I remember a teacher asking me one time, do you think you're going to get rid of desire? And I'm like, yes. And he goes, good luck. But even so, even with an innocent question like that, you know, go try, see, test it out. You know, let yourself find out.
Thank you.
This is Jennifer. So when you were talking about that practice of like, you know, taking in all the loneliness of the world or whatever, and that being too much, like, I don't know, I was thinking about like, sometimes when I read too much news, it's too much and that kind of thing, you know, and like, that sounds like too much to take on all the suffering of the world. And so, like, what's the difference between, like, maybe protecting myself in a healthy way and, like, protecting myself, you know?
I'm glad you brought that up, Jennifer, because I think you start the practice by receiving the care and love. May I, receive that comfort from the bodhisattvas and all beings. May I feel the loving care of people who are with me in my loneliness. I think I got to the sharing piece kind of after I could feel that. And certainly the last part of it where I take it on, I'm not taking it on by myself. I'm taking it on with all beings. I'm taking it on with the bodhisattvas. You know, sometimes I imagine just sitting in Avalokiteshvara's lap. Together we hold it.